supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we all know about the big secrets, Eric Snowden and the recent NSA revelations, the Watergate affair, and various whistleblowers. And we know about the small secrets and lies, the ones we tell every day.
I think it's okay to keep secrets that might hurt someone a lot. If it's not going to affect anything in their relationship going forward, sometimes it's better just to kind of bury the hatchet and keep the secret.
If you got a spouse and you're trying to save face at home, sometimes it's good to tell a little white lie. Nothing major, nothing like, you know, cheating or anything. If you don't want to mess up a happy home, it's good to keep a secret, depending on what it is.
Well, with my boyfriend, I hide packages of Oreos, because I know he'll yell at me if he sees them, so I, like, secretly snack. It's definitely not helping the relationship. It might even hurt it, because I wish that I could just do what I'm going to do.
So, for instance, I have a baby I'm walking right here, and if I let my mother babysit him, right, and I come back and I say, how was he tonight? I don't want to hear if he was bad. I don't want to hear if he was crying all night. I want to hear he was perfect.
If she told you the truth, then you would feel guilty about going out.
Yeah. I would feel guilty about going out. I'd feel like something was wrong, blah, blah, blah. But he's a baby. He's supposed to cry.
So we're protecting the most sensitive feelings.
Mine. Yes.
Thanks to Emily Haas for gathering that wonderful soundbite. Yes, we all tell lies. On days I'm not feeling well, I lie every time somebody asks me how I am. And I want to tell you, some of you might know about that I know secrets about the Bible that very few other people know. So here's what I know, that when God discovered Adam and Eve had eaten the apple, Adam was heard saying, "What apple? I never saw an apple. Eve, did you see an apple?" So, you know, it started way back then, and it's been around forever. So, seriously, why do we hate liars so much? Why do secrets frighten us so much? On today's show, we're going to explore lying, deceit, and secrets, why we all do it, and the emotional price we pay. Joining me is Charles Ford. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Alabama in Birmingham School of Medicine. He's written Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. He joins us by phone. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
We also have David Livingstone Smith. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be with you.
And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Our number, as always, is 888-477-9499. What's your take on how secrets and lies play out in your personal life and, moreover, state secrets? How do you feel about the country keeping secrets from you? Chuck, let's start with you. As a psychiatrist, physician, your interest in lying began innocently enough when you were treating your psychiatric, even medical patients, and saw they were lying to make themselves look better. Don't we all?
Well, I think that lying is such a common phenomenon that, as you mentioned earlier, it occurs almost reflexively. We tell people what they want to hear. They don't want to hear about all of our aches and ills. So when they say, "How are you?" We say fine, even when we feel miserable. I think that the work of Bella DiPaolo at the University of Virginia has shown that people tell, you know, real lies more than just that polite little one, probably on the average of several times a day.
But even to doctors, Chuck? I mean, when they ask how you are, it's like just you're supposed to tell them. But, you know, I read surveys that show even there we gild the lily a little bit.
Unfortunately, we do. In this busy day of medicine where our visits to primary care physicians are ever shorter, the doctor will often ask leading questions such as, nothing's bothering you, is there? trying to keep the appointment as short as possible. But over and beyond that, it's remarkable how frequently patients lie to their physicians, such as whether or not they're taking their medications on a regular basis, whether or not the medication has actually helped, often minimizing symptoms that they think might result in more diagnostic studies or something of that type.
Let me offer a wild guess about what patients might lie about. Perhaps diet, alcohol consumption, drugs, just making a wild guess.
Yeah, and how about sex, too?
You know, they lie about whether they are or are not having it.
Probably both, depending on
But listen, you know, I talked about lying to make ourselves look better. And David, I want to turn to you here. Our brain is really a social organ. It's really an interactive organ. So we do want to look better to others.
Well, we'd better. If you don't make efforts to look better to others, then you're going to have a very, very hard time in life. Our social life is largely, to a huge extent, a matter of impression management.
And this begins, Chuck, lying begins in childhood. Even in the animal kingdom.
Lying is prevalent throughout the animal kingdom, and we start to see lies that at least appear to be consciously motivated in children as young as 2 or maybe even a little bit younger than that.
I have to tell a great story. My daughter has 2 pit bulls, a very smart female pit bull named Marley and a very dumb male pit bull named Eli. And Marley will eat her food first, and while Eli is eating his food, she'll bark over at the door, and Eli will think somebody's there, and he runs over to the door and she eats his food. You know, talk about deceit in the animal kingdom. You know, so it is, and yet, Chuck, parents tell children there's nothing worse than lying.
That's the double message that gets sent to children, and that is one of the double messages throughout life that they have to learn how to manage and negotiate. Because parents say there's nothing worse than a liar, and then encourage their children to lie in a variety of different situations.
How so?
Well, for example, and one of them is when the phone rings and the child picks it up, the parent may be saying, "Tell them I'm not home." Or
gotcha.
They may say, whatever your aunt gives you for your birthday, you tell her how much you love it and how much you appreciate it.
David,
no matter how inappropriate it may be.
David, I want to turn to you. You've said that we should tell our children that they have a right to keep secrets.
Well, of course, yes. All of us, I think, have a need for a personal space, things that we keep to ourselves, just as we make distinctions between what we tell to strangers and what we tell to people who are close to us. So, of course, I think we all have the right to regulate the sort of information about ourselves that we put out to others. And you know, apropos of what you were just speaking about with Chuck, I agree with him entirely, by the way. And I would go further and say parents who don't teach their children how to lie in socially acceptable or even socially mandatory ways are doing their children a great disservice. And most parents do. Most parents explicitly and by example teach their children how to lie and when to lie. And when parents say, you know, you shouldn't lie, you must always tell the truth, I think what they really mean is you shouldn't lie to me.
This brings up a massive theme here that I want to talk about, and that's whistleblowers. So whistleblowers are in an institution that tells them exactly what their families told them, how to behave appropriately or else. And whistleblowers don't do that. So tell me about whistleblowers. I'll start with you, David, and Charles, I want you to weigh in on that.
Okay, so look, I think it's always the case with lies. And I think both Charles and I use the term lie in a very broad way to include all sorts of deceptions that people perpetrate in their social lives. It's always the case with lying, I think, that we need to consider the moral significance of lies. Sometimes it's morally right to lie. Sometimes it's morally right to tell the truth. And in the case of whistleblowers, it's often the case that they feel a moral imperative to tell the truth in circumstances where telling the truth is disapproved of.
That's a sweeping statement. I'm sure there's a lot of nuance in there. Chuck, you want to weigh in on that?
Yes, I would say as a part of the nuance that whistleblowers probably come in more than one category. And there may be the category, certainly, of those who have a very strong sense of morality, of what they believe is right, and that they must then make things open. But there are another group of whistleblowers who are enraged and angry and are destructive, and their purpose is not so much one of morality as it is of vengeance.
And these very visible whistleblowers that we now know, you know, Snowden and Assange from WikiLeaks, we don't know about them. We don't know what kind of whistleblower they are. Chuck?
Well, I certainly don't. and if I did, it would be unethical for me to say. So I can't really hypothesize about something I don't know about.
And well, that's the case with so many whistleblowers. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with psychiatrist Charles Chuck Ford and philosopher David Livingstone Smith. We're talking about secrets, lies, deceit on a state level, on a personal level, and we're going to be talking about it on a family level also. I'd like to hear your take. Do you consider yourself a liar? Do you consider yourself a deceiver? Or what's it like when you've been lied to? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. David, there's got to be a reason why the doubt thou shalt not lie thing is so important. I mean, without some governance on lying, what would happen to our moral compass?
First of all, let's notice that thou shalt not lie is not one of the Ten Commandments. There's a restriction about bearing false witness, which is really quite specific. And indeed, if thou shalt not lie was one of the Ten Commandments, it would be a commandment that everyone breaks, virtually everyone breaks. Of course, look, deception is very odd in the following way. All of us, whether we admit it or not, like to reserve the right to deceive others, but we don't want others to reserve the right to deceive us. Deceiving others puts us, if the deception is successful, in a sort of position of advantage or power with respect to the other. And that's one important reason why it needs to be constrained. And I'm not particularly talking about the petty deceptions of everyday life. I'm talking about more the morally significant deceptions, the deceptions that can really, really make a significant negative difference to one's life if one is at the wrong end of them.
Give us an example.
So your spouse is having an extramarital affair and conceals it from you. I mean, that's the sort of deception that you don't want to be, at least I wouldn't want to be, on the wrong end of. To contrast that, you know, if I go through the motions of saying to the person at the checkout at the grocery store, "How are you?" and they say, "Fine," and they're lying through their teeth, they're having a miserable time, that's of no great consequence. Although I hasten to add, in those circumstances, I do tend to say, well, you know, you don't look like you're having such a great time. Looks like it's been a long day for you.
Oh, God, David, you sound like a therapist now.
Well, I used to be a therapist in my previous career.
What, you go through some kind of recovery program?
No, this is just I think, let's keep therapy out of it. This is just a gesture of human decency. People who do fairly menial tasks are often invisible to us. Right. And I think it's very, very important to acknowledge their humanity.
Yeah.
That we're not treating them simply as sort of devices to get our groceries paid for, but we acknowledge them as human beings.
So, Chuck, I want to pick up on something David mentioned about the extramarital affair. So he said he doesn't want to be on the wrong end of that. You know, that the spouse is having an affair and she or he is keeping it a secret from him. What's the price we pay to be on the other end of that? Can you make a statement about that, to be carrying a major secret in an intimate relationship? What's the price the secret keeper pays?
Well, it's often one of fear and anxiety, and if one grew up in a fairly moralistic family, it may be one of intense guilt. And the discomfort may be so great that the person finally feels a compulsion to reveal, to confess, so to say, and sometimes in a very devastating way. It's interesting that in the AA 12-step programs, one of the steps is to try to make amends to others and to be honest, but there's a little statement after that, in that you right. don't harm another person in doing this. And I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind. Sometimes truth-telling can in itself be very harmful and very malignant. And as a matter of fact, Arnold Goldberg in Chicago wrote a paper once about pathological truth-tellers amongst adolescents. So we have to be careful with the information that we share with others, and that is this information helpful to them? Or may it be harmful to them?
I treated a man years ago who grew up in a family where both of his parents insisted that any secret is a lie and is bad. And he's having great difficulty in his life. So when you know, he would go out on a date and the person had bad breath, he would tell them. You know, and, you know, he had all sorts of social problems, and he came into therapy to try to learn, you know, when to lie and when not to lie. By the way, one of our engineers said that, could these guys teach us how to lie better? I mean, is there a way to do it better, David?
Well, of course there is. I mean, like lying skillfully, successfully is indeed a passport to success, because to be successful socially, it is very, very important that you present yourself in a favorable light. There are sort of sensible ways to lie, and there are, like I said, morally mandatory ways to lie. There are situations in which if you don't lie, you're being profoundly destructive and immoral, and there are inappropriate ways to lie. Now, a lot of people just have a really good feel for this, and others find it very difficult either to lie appropriately, they lie unnecessarily in such circumstances where it's really a useless thing to do, or they lie lie or tell the truth, actually, in self-destructive ways.
Mm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about lies, deceit, secrets, really what's good about them and what's bad about them. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back with questions about family secrets and state secrets. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking with Dr. Charles Chuck Ford. He's a psychiatrist at the University of Alabama School of Medicine, who's written Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit, and David Livingstone Smith, a professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's the author of Why We Lie, and his most recent book is Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. It's really a fascinating read. Well, like I said, our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Secrets, deceit, and lies are what we're talking about today with psychiatrist Charles Ford, professor of philosophy David Livingstone Smith. David, you've got an interesting take on secrets. And you said that if people knew everything about us, they'd have power over us. Mm-hmm. And I want to challenge that and suggest perhaps the opposite, that with each secret we keep, we give power away.
Well, why would you say that?
Well, I have found in my life and the lives of my patients that the more secrets we keep, the more closed off we feel, the more shame and fear we carry.
It depends who you're keeping the secrets from, and indeed, secrets are a double-edged sword. They protect us and they distance us at the same time. I doubt if you would entertain the idea that everything about you should be accessible to everyone. Rather, I think that there are certain things about you that you entrust only to very special people. There might be things that you only entrust to yourself. And indeed, there are probably things that you don't even entrust to yourself. There are secrets we keep from ourselves as well. But the important thing here, I think, is the discriminating between who receives what information. Who can we trust with certain information about ourselves?
Chuck, what's your take?
Well, I think I'm in agreement with David. Secrets are necessary for us to maintain our sense of autonomy, our sense of being separate, our sense of self. And if we share too much of that, I think the boundaries become very blurred, and people and we don't lose our personal sense of identity. On the other hand, the sharing of some secrets, and let me use an example. We said we weren't going to talk about therapy, but let me do it for a moment anyway. And that is, I'm a psychiatrist. I live in basically a rural state. Patients may come in from rural counties. They look at me as someone that they can't relate to. And I may share a bit of personal information. Mm-hmm. I grew up on a farm. I was an Aggie. I started college in the College of Agriculture. I may share this with them. And all of a sudden, the bonding that we have is markedly increased, and my capacity to help them is increased. Now, I don't tell them about my secret sexual fantasies or things of that type. That would not be helpful. Now, secrets also have a bonding quality within a family, and you'll see that where family members may have all seen perhaps a social faux pas by one of the members of the family that's become funny through the years, and they may refer to it by a glance, a look, a smile or something. That holds the family together, and it's a secret that outsiders don't know, but that makes the family feel closer to one another.
I do want to mention this clinically. That many, many of the secrets we keep are about our own vulnerability, that fear of having our own vulnerability exposed. And there's a lot of research now suggesting that a lot of our symptoms, a lot of our internal discord is about our intolerance of our own vulnerability. Brené Brown is, is on the forefront of this research. Chuck?
Yes, I would have to say, of course, that's true, that we want to hide our vulnerabilities. We want to think of ourselves as strong. I think that we gain a great deal when we have an intimate relationship in which we can share some of those vulnerabilities and talk about them. Mm. But on the other hand, when I go for a job interview, I don't want to lay them right out in front of somebody.
Right. Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation, and I've been hugging you guys. Let's go to Kathy. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, Dan. I just had a quick story to share about my mother. She always spoke about telling the truth and how important it was. And one day when I was just a little preschooler at home with her, at age 4, someone came to our door, and I expected to follow mother over to the door and see who was there. And instead, my mother goes into the downstairs bathroom and steps into this dry bathtub with all of her clothes on. So I'm befuddled. And she says to me, "Go to the door, Kathy, and tell the gentleman at the door that your mother's in the tub and he'll have to come back at another time," which I did. And it wasn't until many years later that I found out that she just wasn't comfortable with that particular person being in our home when my father wasn't there.
and she didn't want you to tell a lie.
Right.
Oh, man. She's great. That's great. It's a great story. Thanks so much for that story. David, do you see a change over the decades about how we feel about lying? For example, we assume, I think, that politicians are going to lie. Do we seem to be more mistrustful of one another?
I don't know. I mean, that's always a tempting thought to think. I would guess that the levels of trust with respect to some issues at one time and other issues another time fluctuate with history. I don't think we're particularly less. My impression is, anyway, that we're not particularly less trustful now than, I don't know, 40 years ago or whatever. And, of course, whenever we say we need to look into what that means as well. Do we mean Americans, affluent Americans? Do we mean people in general in the whole world? There's a mosaic, a spectrum of attitudes and a spectrum of situations that those attitudes go with. And I wouldn't generalize on this matter.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jim on the line. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Okay. What can we do for you?
My 13-year-old daughter habitually lies, whether it's something small as far as washing her face and she'll look you square in the eyes and tell you that she did even though you didn't, or something even a little bit larger, like when she's not supposed to use her iPod or anything that, you know, you ask her about responsibility, she tends to lie about it, and she is constantly getting discovered about it, and then she'll forget why she was punished or something was taken away, or nothing seems to get through to her on the cause and effect of telling the truth.
Well, Chuck, I'd like to hear your thoughts about this first.
Well, there are two thoughts that I have, and one is the lying so pervasive that it's really very destructive to the daughter in the long run, at which time I think this is a symptom that needs to be further explored. But at the same time, when we look at teenagers, that 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old age, lying is very common, and it's a developmental state. It's where they're beginning to say, I have to separate myself from my parents. I'm not a part of my parents. And one of the ways I can achieve that separation is by not letting them know everything I do or everything that I think, and therefore I may have to lie in order to achieve that separation.
I love that answer, Chuck. And Jim, let me add something else. When I first heard you talking, I thought my first reaction was, well, this is a relationship issue, that she keeps doing one thing, you keep doing the other, and it keeps going on. Mm-hmm. So it's a relationship issue. And I don't know her level of maturity. 13-year-olds being 13,
she's a bit behind for her age.
All right. So I don't know if she's got the maturity to sit down and have a conversation. But to have a conversation without you as being the enforcer and her as being, you know, the wayward kid, but just to talk about what's happening in the relationship, her feelings, your feelings, what you need to learn and what she needs to learn. And if both of you could be open, maybe you could improve the relationship. That's my greatest concern right now is the quality of your relationship with her.
We do a lot of things together. We have a good relationship and model good behavior, but she doesn't seem to be able to understand right from wrong and doesn't seem to understand why she chooses to lie.
Well, I don't know if she understands or not why she chooses to lie. I would hope she'd have room to explore that, you know, about why she chooses to lie. I wonder if you could have that discussion about, you know, how come? How come you did it? You know, is there something that goes on between us that makes you want to lie? Or, you know, as Chuck said, is it just a developmental issue? But you want, even if it is a developmental issue, you really want to get through this with your relationship being good and trusting on both your parts. So I wish you the best. I hope this advice was somewhat helpful, and, you know, let's hope it's simply a developmental issue, and as she gets her boundaries, she'll be feeling better and more comfortable with herself. We're talking about secrets, deceits, and lies, and we've got a lot of people on the line. We do have a few lines open. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're going to take a short break. We're talking with David Livingstone Smith. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's written Why We Lie. His most recent book is Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. I have a feeling that has to do in part with lying to ourselves, and I want to follow that up after the break. Also with Dr. Charles Chuck Ford, a professor of psychiatry at University of Alabama School of Medicine. He's written Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view June 27th through October 13th, Jennifer Bartlett, History of the Universe, Works 1970 to 2011, an unprecedented 40-year survey of an acclaimed American artist of the 20th century. Over the course of her 50-year career, Bartlett has become known for her process-oriented, abstract works that offer viewers challenging and inventive narratives. More information online at paafa.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, new co-host for Here and Now. Join Robin Young and me on WHYY at 1 p.m., a full 2 hours of all the news that breaks after Morning Edition and before All Things Considered. And, of course, the local news you've come to rely on each and every day. Here and Now on WHYY.
Secrets, Lies, and Deception with psychiatrist Charles Chuck Ford and professor of philosophy David Livingstone Smith. You know, gentlemen, I heard a monologue by Jackie Mason that I may have mentioned here on the show many years ago. And, you know, he's on his analyst's couch, and the analyst, he says to the analyst, what are we going to do here? And the analyst says, well, we're going to help you find your unconscious. And Jackie Mason says, my unconscious is none of my business. And, you know, that's a little bit of what we're saying here. We, you know, we do lie to ourselves. David, that gets to my question about your new book, Less Than Human. Why do we demean, enslave, and exterminate others? What is it in our mechanism in our brain that enables us to do that?
Well, it's really for asking the motivational question. One reason is that either it's advantageous to us or we believe that it's advantageous to us to exploit others, to harm them, to, you know, to steal their stuff, to enslave them. But self-deception comes in the following way. We also have very strong inhibitions against doing harm to other human beings. Those of us who aren't sociopaths, anyway, have these very strong inhibitions. And the story that I tell in the book is all about a sort of self-deceptive gimmick that people use, and by the way, governments exploit, to disable those inhibitions. And those inhibitions are disabled by the self-deceptive belief that the people that we wish to harm or to exploit are not really human beings. So they're excluded from the moral category that we put other human beings in.
That's the only way
we're men, or they're predators, or they're some other creature that that it's either okay to harm or even morally obligatory to harm.
That's the only way wars could be fought.
Oh, yes. I mean, if you know, remember the old poster from the 60s, what if they gave a war and nobody came?
Yeah.
Well, lies about war are very pervasive and have been for a very long time, partially because if people knew what they were really like, they would be less enthusiastic to participate in them.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Duncan on the line. Hey, Duncan.
Hi. This is an interesting show, and I'm enjoying it, but you, until just now, you're touching on sociopaths. You pretty much ignored and skirted the issue with the exception of a few callers who called in about their parents and their children. And I offer you the following Oscar Wilde quote: "Telling the truth makes us burn with the desire to convince our audience, whereas telling a lie affords us ample time to study the result." Now, why are novelists and writers, are they not liars? Of course they are. James Dickey died, brilliant novelist. When he died, his son found all sorts of extenuating, incriminating evidence that almost everything that his father had told him through his life was a lie, a series of lies. And the son did write a book about it, his discovery. But Wilde, I think, put it absolutely perfectly. And we sort of, if you've ever been victim to a pathological liar, it's a creative act, even though it's a destructive creative act.
Well, yeah, well, it's, you know, let me give you a front promote a show that we're probably going to have next month on memoir writing and, you know, telling one's own story. One of my editors said to me that as soon as you put the letter I down on a piece of paper, you're telling a lie. Because who knows what the truth is about how we tell our story about who we are. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Anne on line 4. Anne, hi.
Hi,
you're on the air.
Hi, I love your show every week.
Thank you.
My whole life has been devastated by what I believe my daughter must be telling a lie. She has really exterminated me from my life for the last 10, 11 years. She's 46. I'm 71. I don't know how she can live without telling people what her mother, her family, exists of. She must tell them maybe I'm either dead or that I wronged her. I don't know if she's sick. I know she doesn't like that I am fat. I'm very fat. And I'm uneducated. And she is, you know, she's the way she should be as far as her body and her education. She's a very nice person. Everything I've seen of her is very nice. She won't communicate with me.
In 10 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
She won't answer phones, letters. I send greeting cards. I do get a Christmas card usually. I don't think I got one this past year. Says nothing on it.
Yeah. Here's what we know for sure. And Chuck, I want to hear your thoughts about this for Anne. We really don't know, Anne, what your daughter is saying about you. We don't know what she's thinking about you. We have no idea. We have no idea what's going on with her. What we do know for sure is that you're suffering. And how you're suffering, I don't know. Are you in mourning? Are you still hoping and wishing for something that may or may not come? Do you feel you've lost your daughter or are losing her? You know, it's important for you to know your own experience, and you need the care for your, what I assume is broken heart, And that's far more important than to me than understanding your daughter's motives, because that's unlikely that you'll ever know that. Chuck, what are your thoughts for Anne here?
Well, again, not knowing the details, I can't speak directly to that except to, again, express the feeling of the understanding of the pain. And frequently we need to mourn. We often have to mourn and grieve the loss of relationships, even when we don't understand the reasons for that. To go back, though, to the interrelationship of lying and self-deception, people may tell lies to protect themselves from the truth.
Sure.
Which is an interesting thing. So they create a whole story and may spread it out to others. And if others believe it, then it reinforces their own belief in the new story. But what they're doing is covering up and providing a screen over the real issues, which are too painful for the individual to deal with.
So give us an example of that, Chuck.
Well, we may have someone who, for example, viciously goes after a spouse with complaints of abuse or sexual abuse or something of that type as a way of covering up their own feelings of total inadequacy within the relationship and their own feelings of low self-esteem. It's that way. It's not my fault. It's not that I have failed. It's that that SOB or that bitch or someone else has created this situation.
I want to turn to you, David, about institutional lying. Some institutions lie as part of the fabric of the institution. I mean, we talked about how government activities sometimes require lie and deceit to function. And, you know, some institutions lie to protect people, and some institutions lie to protect themselves. I mean, this Penn State scandal and many of the child abuse problems in the Catholic Church, that here's an institution that lies to protect itself.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And this applies on the individual and family level as well. Sometimes we lie to protect ourselves illegitimately. Sometimes we lie to protect ourselves legitimately. So there's some sorts of information which, if it were to be revealed, would create danger.
Well, I want to come back, though, and talk about lies in the family. And you know, I know that when parents lie to their children, themselves or each other, it generates increased anxiety and mistrust in the family. I'm talking about big lies. So Daddy had an affair, and Mommy knows about it and has not forgiven him. Now, the kids don't need to know the information, but they sure can feel the emotion, and that emotion affects their lives.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
So what's to be done, Doc?
Well, you know, I think that it's often the case that children can handle a lot more truth than we give them credit for. And sometimes I think that adults they experience shame in telling children the truth, and they rationalize their own experience of shame or their own fear of feeling shame by convincing themselves that they have to protect the children. You know, a lot of truth can be told in an appropriate manner, and everyone comes off the better. It's particularly destructive, I think, when there are big lies that are creating discord, because either children have figured out what's going on vaguely and are confronted with massive denial around them, so it's forbidden to acknowledge what's true, or I think much worse,
the whole situation becomes unintelligible. Children can't understand, you know, what's going on, what's producing these tensions and discords. And, of course, then they'll fill in the blanks with their own fantasies.
Hmm. Yeah, and that happens inevitably. It's as though we are afraid to show our children that we are vulnerable, human, if you will,
yeah,
for fear of losing their respect. But, I mean, it really does just the opposite.
Yeah, it does just the opposite. That's right.
So, David, what about advertisers? We expect them to lie, huh?
Well, that's in the broad understanding of lying, that's what advertising is largely about. It's a selective presentation in a positive light of some product. In the case of politicians, of course, it's the product is themselves. Yeah. So yes, we factor that in, and then advertisers, of course, make ever more strenuous efforts to overcome our sales resistance.
Yeah, and lie even better. The strange thing about us humans is in the moment we listen to it, we believe it, or we make ourselves believe it. We're just a funny species. And
we're suckers for words.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Unfortunately, we're out of town. We sure have covered a wide range of issues around this. And I want to thank you both so very much, Charles Ford and David Livingstone Smith. Thank you both.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about when there's no explanation for the symptoms we have. More and more people are suffering with that, physically and emotionally. So if you've got a comment or thought about today's show, we'd love to hear from you. We're at whyy.org/voices. You can download our show there also. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Anna DiStefano is our summer intern. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. As always, thanks, Jennifer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.
You're listening to